From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Happy Thanksgiving. In addition to the holiday, we're celebrating two centennials and a birthday today. This is the centennial year of actor Charles Laughton, the star of such films as The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Mutiny on the Bounty, and This Land Is Mine. We'll hear from actor Simon Callow, author of a biography of Laughton. It's also Duke Ellington's centennial year. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new reissues featuring Ellington's sidemen. Pianist George Shearing is celebrating his 80th birthday with a concert at Carnegie Hall next week. We'll hear an interview from our archives with him. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Coast Guard says as many as 8 Cubans may have drowned when their small boat sank as they tried to make it from Cuba to the coast of Florida. Two survivors of the sinking, a man and woman, struggled ashore today on Key Biscayne. They told officials that they saw 7 people drown when the boat sank in bad weather. They held onto an inflated inner tube while 5 other people caught hold of a second tube. The Coast Guard found the second inner tube today, along with a 5-year-old boy who survived and the body of an elderly woman. 4 of the 7 major U.S. airlines have raised their fares this week. The increases are averaging 3%. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The 3 airlines that haven't raised prices are Northwest, U.S. Airways, and TWA. It was American Airlines that started the trend on Monday, followed over the next 2 days by Delta, United, and Continental. Most of the airlines aren't commenting on their reasons. Analysts point out that jet fuel is the second largest expense for an airline after labor costs, and oil prices are now the highest they've been since the Persian Gulf War in 1991. At the same time, airline seats are in great demand. This holiday weekend, the industry expects to carry nearly 20 million passengers, a record. It's illegal for airlines to coordinate price hikes, so over the next several days, they're likely to be watching each other to see if the holdouts raise their prices or stand fast. Peter Overby, NPR News.
Many poor families in Missouri got a festive meal at Thanksgiving. The Salvation Army in Columbia served dinner for the homeless and the lonely. Deborah Johnson reports from Columbia.
A young girl stared wide-eyed at the desserts as she held her father's hand. There are people hugging and greeting each other and children running, playing, and laughing. The Salvation Army fed over 800 people for the 15th year running. Commanding Officer Major Max Grindle says they offer this holiday meal to anyone in mid-Missouri.
We don't say it's we're low-income, we're the poor, or anything like that. We say it's a community dinner. There'll be people coming in who could afford their own, but they're all by themselves, and so they come here and have fellowship with other people. We have some families that will be coming in, so it's open to everybody.
The food was donated by local businesses and residents. The space for the dinner was donated by a local restaurant. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Johnson in Columbia, Missouri.
The Croatian government began proceedings today to have President Franjo Tudjman declared temporarily unfit to carry out his duties. Tudjman has been in the hospital for the past month after he developed complications from emergency intestinal surgery. The 77-year-old leader is widely rumored to be suffering from cancer. If Croatia's highest court determines that Tudjman is unfit to govern, the presidency would be turned over to the Speaker of Parliament. A decision could come as early as tomorrow. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin is suffering from bronchitis and a viral infection. His illness delayed the signing of a union treaty between Russia and the former Soviet Republic of Belarus. Renee McGuffin reports from Moscow.
Kremlin sources say the Russian president was taken to the hospital Thursday and, after being diagnosed with bronchitis and a viral infection, is now resting at his Gorky 9 residence just outside Moscow. Yeltsin's sickness has forced the postponement of Friday's signing ceremony of a pending treaty, increasing the formal ties between Russia and its neighbor Belarus. The proposed union is opposed by liberals in both countries, who complain that it will add legitimacy to the hardline regime of the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko. Before receiving treatment at the Central Clinical Hospital, the Russian president met with his Prime Minister Vladimir Putin and other security officials to discuss the country's military campaign in Chechnya. The Russian prime minister has been handling day-to-day affairs for the ailing Yeltsin. The Russian president's second term in office has been marred by numerous bouts of illness that have often kept him from the Kremlin for weeks at a time. For NPR News, I'm Renee McGuffin in Moscow.
An appeals court in Ankara, Turkey, has upheld the treason and separatism convictions of Kurdish guerrilla leader Abdullah Öcalan. The two convictions carry mandatory death sentences, which still must be endorsed by Parliament and President Süleyman Demirel before they can be carried out. Turkey has many prisoners facing the death sentence, but has not carried out an execution for 15 years. Turkey's European allies have opposed the death sentence for Öcalan, warning that Turkey's effort to join the European Union could be jeopardized. Many members of parliament and the Turkish public blame Öcalan for tens of thousands of deaths during the Kurdish insurrection, and they want him executed. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is the centennial year of British actor Charles Laughton. The actor-critic David Thompson described as having one of the most interesting and troubled careers in the cinema. The Brooklyn Academy of Music will begin a Laughton film retrospective in December. Laughton starred in such films as The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Mutiny on the Bounty, and This Land is Mine, and directed the classic Night of the Hunter. I spoke with actor Simon Callow about Laughton in 1988, after the publication of Callow's biography of Laughton. Callow was also the author of a biography of Orson Welles. Callow's own film roles include the villain in Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, the character who's buried in Four Weddings and a Funeral, and the Reverend in A Room with a View. Callow says Laughton's greatest achievement was his performance as Quasimodo in the 1939 film The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Callow writes, "This performance is acting at its greatest. This is Laughton as the Hunchback."
I never realized till now how ugly I am. And because you're so beautiful. I'm not a man. I'm not a beast. I'm about as shapeless as the man in the moon.
I want to ask you a little bit about your biography of Charles Laughton. Now, you think that his greatest performance was in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and I've seen that movie a lot of times, and it's really one of my very favorite movies. Laughton was a heavy man during part of his life and didn't think of himself as an attractive man. Do you think he identified a lot with the character he was playing?
I think it went beyond identification. I think he projected his deepest, darkest feelings about himself, his dislike, as you say, of his own body, onto a huge canvas. I mean, he certainly he did identify with Quasimodo, but he also externalized that feeling and turned it into an epic feeling of self-rejection. I must explain. I think it's quite an important thing to say. It's a commonplace of criticism of Charles Laughton that he didn't like his own body, that he thought he was ugly. And the question that I asked myself was, if a man thinks that he's ugly, why would he parade that fact in front of millions of people?
Mm-hmm.
And I added to that the interesting fact that I had heard from many people that whenever Charles Laughton was alone at home, I mean among friends, or even not among friends, but when he was at his house by his pool in Los Angeles, the first thing he would do would be tear off all his clothes and stand naked and very fat and very strikingly very unattractive. Now, it doesn't seem to me that somebody who really dislikes themselves does that. It seems to me that Charles Laughton actually used a certain feeling that he had about himself and amplified it and magnified it to turn it into art of some kind.
Now, you said that you think he risked madness
For going as deeply as he did into his performance as Quasimodo, the disfigured hunchback in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Tell us a little bit about the kind of makeup and the hump that he had to use to physically resemble Quasimodo. It is really one of the... I remember when I first saw that as a child, I was just horrified at the way that he looked. Describe a little bit his face and his back, and then what kind of makeup he had to carry to pull that off.
Well, he devised that makeup in conjunction with a man called Perse Westmore, who was the most famous makeup artist, really, of all time. And they didn't really like each other at all. But Charles was a relentless taskmaster, and he knew very clearly what he wanted. And he pushed Perse Westmore further and further and further until he devised this amazing structure for his face. I mean, on his back he had a kind of a structure made of a light steel frame.
Which would be very heavy, probably.
And foam padding, which was strapped onto him. He had to be strapped into it. And that was extremely uncomfortable, especially when you remember that the film was filmed in September of 1939, and that year was as hot as it's just been in New York. And people were going mad in the same way. And Charles Laughton wore this terrible frame on his back and all this foam rubber inside. And on his face, he had a huge rubber and latex structure which contained within it a false eye which actually worked.
I mean, it could move.
It moved. It was lower. It was down on his cheek. The other eye was blocked out completely. And it moved. It was linked by a thread to his other eye, to his own eye. So as every time he blinked with his free eye, the false eye blinked as well. And that was a structure of wires and threads underneath the mask. And the rest of his face was pushed out of all proportion. His jaw was pushed forward. And as I say, there was this terrible heat all the time.
So he really suffered every time he got into the character.
He suffered every time. He clearly needed... I mean, he felt that it was necessary to suffer in order to give the performance. But as I point out in the book, the most striking thing about the performance is not how much he indulges in the pain, but what a stoical character he endows Quasimodo with. You understand that he suffers terribly from his ugliness and from his physical deformity. But in fact, what you see is Quasimodo rising above that. And you see an essential sweetness and a simplicity of the man.
What a really good point. You know, there's the scene where he's on the wheel being lashed. This is the scene that ends with him begging for water.
Yeah.
You say that he had asked a makeup man to twist his foot to help him feel physical pain so he could express that pain in his acting.
That's right.
And I wonder what you think about that kind of acting where you need to actually physically experience the pain in order to express it as an actor.
I understand it. I understand that it is necessary. I understand that it can be very productive. I would never do it myself.
Why not?
In my case, first of all, I must admit, I'm squeamish about pain, and I don't want to. I don't want to suffer. I mean, I
don't blame you.
Very, very hard about making a film in the jungle. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it just doesn't. It's not something that sort of attracts me, suffering. But and it did attract Charles, obviously. But I'm not really drawn to the characters, the kind of characters that Charles was drawn to. I suppose if I were playing Quasimodo, I would have to do something like that. I find for myself, I mean, you must understand that at no point am I ever comparing myself with Charles Laughton in terms of greatness. He was, you know, what Beethoven is to composing, Laughton was to acting, in a league apart, and I'm not. I find that for myself, my mind seems to create the imaginative contacts. I don't find it profitable for myself to put myself into those kind of odd physical situations. I mean, many actors get great value from pretending to be the character and walking around the streets in character or something like that. That's never really particularly worked for me, but I respect it greatly. I find it fascinating.
You describe how Bertolt Brecht asked Lawton once why he acts.
Yeah.
And Lawton gave two great answers, and I want to ask you about each of them. First,
yeah.
Lawton said, I act because I like to imitate great men.
Yes.
Why is that of interest to you? I find that a great answer.
It's a wonderful answer, and it must have delighted Brecht, because, first of all, he used the word imitate. He didn't say, like, I like to be great men, or I like to pretend. He said, I like to imitate. I like to look at and copy and then show to people. When you imitate somebody, you very definitely say, I mean, you say, I am taking on the characteristics of somebody else. Look what kind of a person this is. And that's what delighted Brecht. And it's what Charles did actually all the time.
Let's get to the second answer that Lawton gave about why he acts. He said he acts because people don't know what they're like, and he thinks he can show them.
Yeah.
What a terrific answer, you know, to try to explain people to themselves through acting.
Yes, exactly. He was a close observer of people, but more particularly a close observer of himself. And I think he was a very conscious man. That's very important to say about him. He knew what he was doing.
Does that sum up to you what great acting is, a performance that can show people what they are?
It certainly could be, yes. I mean, there are very many kinds of acting, but anything which affirms humanity, anything which says anything which celebrates the richness of human life, is that begins to be a great performance to me.
My guest is actor Simon Callow. We're talking about his biography of Charles Lawton. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1988 interview with Simon Callow about his biography of actor Charles Lawton. This is Lawton's centennial year.
When you started to act, you write in your autobiography that you initially only wanted to play leads and that later on you realized the importance of secondary roles. So I'd like to know what you think the importance of secondary roles is.
Oh, well, absolutely crucial. And, there's nothing more awful than watching a star performer surrounded by people who are not in his league. I mean, it's bad for him, it's bad for the play, it's bad in every way. But what is fascinating is how hard it is to play, as you call them, secondary roles, smaller parts, are very, very hard to play. As a leading actor, you've got the whole play and the whole extent of the role on which, as it were, to warm yourself up. And if you miss one scene, you don't play it quite as well as you should have done, you've got the next scene to recover on. But so often an actor playing a small part has really got to make his impact within this tiny compass. He's got to make all his points, and on the other hand, try not to sell it too hard, which you do sometimes see. You can often see in television programs, you know, people who've got to sort of break a play and play and finally get to play a small part on television, oversell it because it's they want to make an impact. They want to show people everything they can do all at once, and so you need a sort of restraint and a discipline. And it's fascinating how wonderfully great actors who've played very big leading parts, they play small parts so beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
They just etch them in because they have the absolute confidence of having used their whole instrument all the time. So it's like, you know, playing a violin or something. The violin has to be warm before you can play on it properly.
Now,
and it's very hard as a small part actor to get warm.
In the movie Amadeus, you played a kind of secondary role. You were the impresario Emmanuel Schickenrader?
That's right.
Who wrote the libretto for The Magic Flute, and as you describe him, he was covered in feathers during most of the performance. Now, you actually originated the role of Mozart in the original British stage production of Amadeus. And in your autobiography, you describe how difficult it was to make it convincing that this man who was portrayed as a real louse in the play would be capable of writing and performing such brilliant music. What key did you find to making it believable?
Well, what I did was to apply myself to the music more and more. I listened to it incessantly. I tried, this is a very hard thing to talk about, but I tried to kind of put the music into the center of me. I tried to sort of inject it into my spine so as there was always in my mind, as I think there must have been always in Mozart's mind, an endless flow of music bubbling out and pouring through. And I then played against that because, as you say, perhaps even more than in the movie, in the stage play, Peter Schaffer's created a very partial view of Mozart. I mean, it's all true, but it's not the whole truth about Mozart. And he wanted to show what was well attested by all his Mozart's contemporaries, that he was a pain in the ass most of the time, and a kind of childish, noisy, vulgar creature. And I had to find, though, as you said at the beginning, I had to make it credible that that man wrote that music.
You know, we were talking earlier about Charles Laughton's looks and how he thought of himself as being ugly, and how he ended up playing the disfigured hunchback of Notre Dame. Do you think acting has become more about looking good than it once was? I'm thinking now that so many of the leading younger actors get to act because they're good looking. And it just appears to me as a viewer that it's getting more and more difficult for actors who are not beautiful or handsome to get good performances, I mean, to get good parts.
Yeah. Yes, I think that is probably true. I mean, I've got nothing against people looking good, and it's very nice to look at them for a while. But it is an interesting question, one which I have no answer for, as to whether people who are terribly good-looking really make an encounter with themselves which would lead to interesting acting. I mean, Betty Davis rather sagely said a long time ago, she said, I'm not saying you have to be neurotic to be an actor, but I don't believe that anybody who likes themselves ever became one.
Really? And does that have resonance for you?
Oh, deeply, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's the most wonderful escape partly into other characters or other parts of yourself that you might have been, but also into a sort of, what I always say, but there's a kind of perfection about acting. I mean, you say all the right things, you do the right moves. It's for the period that you're on the stage or in front of the camera, you are actually perfectly fulfilled. And life can be very disappointing sometimes by comparison. But certainly, I mean, I don't think I would have become an actor if I hadn't felt ill at ease with myself.
Charles Laughton was a homosexual or bisexual, I guess I'm not sure which, but you described that as being one of the big secrets of his life and something that you think finally helped energize his acting. And I was wondering if you think it's any easier now for gay actors in England or the United States to come out, and if you think that the scene, as far as coming out, is any different in England than it is in the United States.
I think it might be. It's in the book that I wrote, Being an Actor, I made a point of saying that I was gay, and as far as I knew, or know, no other actor had ever volunteered such information about himself. I mean, one or two actors had, as it were, got caught in the act, and therefore people knew. But I'm not aware of any other actor in England who had said that he was gay, or she was gay. It didn't seem to have any terrible repercussions on my career, but then on the other hand, I've never been a romantic actor, and therefore maybe it there was no question of people not being able to believe in me as a straight lover or something like that.
We're really out of time, but let me ask you really quickly. Is part of the reason why you came out because you had seen gay actors have to publicly repress so much that it had a negative effect on their lives and their career because they couldn't be honest?
Yeah, partly. I mean, the main reason was just personal. It's just that I'm very bad at keeping secrets, and I just thought it was absurd. I'm very bad at telling lies.
It's funny an actor should say that they're bad at telling lies.
Well, it's funny that you should think that it's funny. acting has nothing to do with lying. Acting has everything to do with telling the truth.
I guess that's true, but it's the ability to be somebody else and be it with conviction, and to say something that you don't necessarily believe with conviction.
You use other parts of yourself. I mean, you don't ever, seriously, you never become anybody else. You only become what you might have been. So it's not a lie. I mean, all these things are in all of us. I mean, if I play a fascist, and I say fascist-like things, if I say them merely as the kind of thing that other people sometimes say, then it'll be of no use at all. Only if I reveal the fascist in me when I say them, and there is one, and there is in everyone, will it be any use?
I want to thank you so much for talking with us about acting. Thank you.
Bye.
Simon Callow, recorded in 1988 after the publication of his biography of Charles Laughton. Here's Laughton in a scene from Mutiny on the Bounty. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Gentlemen, looking about me, I can't believe we're at sea again in a ship of the Royal Navy. Dick's like a barnyard. Paradise is astern, gentlemen. I'll break the men of that island if I have to flog every scurvy thieving which reminds me of Mr. Christian. 10 coconuts, Crown property, were stolen last night during your watch. Am I correct, Mr. Mayes?
Yes, sir. I counted them myself.
I can account for the men in my watch, sir. They didn't take them.
Can you account for yourself?
Mr. Bly, may I recall the outward voyage? Some harsh things were said then, but I've been hoping the return trip would be more fortunate.
Suppose you return the 10 coconuts.
You don't think I'm so fond of coconuts that I'd steal them, do you?
Yes, you hypocrite, I do. You've already stolen Crown property far more valuable.
Explain that.
The pearls, Mr. Christian.
Pearls?
I believe I said pearls. Fortunately, Mr. Maggs was at the boat. He saw that native woman. Give you 2 pearls.
I think I'm beginning to understand. The native woman, as you choose to call her, gave the pearls to me. They are not Crown property.
Mr. Christian, the goods I gave away among the natives belong to the Crown. Whatever comes back from the natives belongs to the Crown. I'm not the most patient man in the world. Give them to me!
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Time Magazine and Time Digital, this week a Tech User's Guide, a review of electronic and home entertainment products. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's trumpeter Cootie Williams playing Duke Ellington's new concerto for Cootie. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new reissues by Ellington Sidemen. Pianist George Shearing is celebrating his 80th birthday with a Carnegie Hall concert next week. We'll listen back to a 1986 interview with Shearing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jazz pianist George Shearing turned 80 earlier this year. He's celebrating with a birthday concert at Carnegie Hall next Tuesday. We're going to hear a 1986 interview with him. Shearing was born in London and was blind from birth. In the 1940s, he was one of England's most popular jazz musicians. But after World War II, he decided to move to New York, the center of modern jazz. He became an American citizen in 1956. This was the decade in which he enjoyed his greatest commercial success. Let's listen to his quintet's recording of his best-known composition, Lullaby of Birdland. Shearing recorded in 1952. Shearing now records for the Telarc label. When I spoke with him in 1986, he told me that as a child, he studied piano at a school for the blind. I asked him if his teachers were confident that a blind person could master the piano.
I don't think it's a question of whether a blind child could master the piano as whether a blind child can make a living in anything other than playing in the pubs, which is where I started. You've got to remember one thing, Terry, and that is that if I chose, say, to be a studio musician, it's obviously necessary to read music. And yes, I can read Braille music, but that's not sight reading, sighted music. You might find 30 pages of manuscript paper with so many notes on it, just as if, you know, flies were all over it. And we always say that there are some sighted people who read so well that if a fly appeared on the paper, they'd read it, you know. This is not available to the blind. But playing in the pub was, and eventually getting my own group was. And from there I went with an all-blind band, 15 blind guys, learning to play instruments from being basket makers and chair caners. We were playing arrangements of Jimmy Lunsford and Duke Ellington and people like that.
How did you find each other? Who organized the band?
The National Institution for the Blind. People used to write all the parts out in Braille. I was the only one who didn't read his part. I could pick it up by ear because I learned a lot of the records as well. There were a couple of people in that band, the first trumpet player and the drummer, who had everything from, early Miff Mole and stuff like that, all the way through Teddy Wilson and Tatum and Fats Waller. And these people all kind of became my mentors, as you can imagine. So it was that was a really wonderful training ground.
Just as you were really coming of age and, well, you'd already started your recording career, the war came along. How was the music scene in London changed by the war, and was there any place to perform or even places to listen during the war?
I had more work than I could handle because there were so many people called up. I would be doing studio work in the daytime because there was enough of it that didn't demand reading, and they couldn't afford to be that fussy any longer. So I learned the charts and did the recordings and the jazz broadcasts and whatever was involved. I did theater, two shows in theater, 8 and 10 at night. I went on to a supper club and played from 10:30 until about 1:30, and then on to a nightclub and played till 4, and then back in the studios the next morning at 10. I had much more work than I could handle.
Were you ever bombed while you were performing during the war?
Oh, yes. First of all, my mother was bombed out 3 times. And I was in a cab one night going to work, and we stopped at a traffic light. We heard this tremendous blast, and the cab shook like mad, And I said, boy, that was a close one, wasn't it? And there was no answer. And I said, that was a close one, wasn't it? And I put my hand in front, and the driver's gone. He ducked in a doorway, and when it was all clear, he came out again. I said, thanks a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, didn't you also do some playing inside air raid shelters during the
war?
Oh,
yes.
What kind of setup was that, there'd be a piano there?
I met my first wife in an air raid shelter. And what we did, we played in the basement, which had been turned into a gymnasium. And there were kind of forms, you know, benches that one could sleep on or on the floor, and there were blankets and stuff. And there would be an upright piano there. So I was living with a song plugger at the time, and he and I would play four hands, much to the amusement of people that went, you know, down in that particular air raid shelter.
So you think it helped pass the time for everybody?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, sure. I mean, you had to make a life. I mean, you had no alternative. 15 hours a day, the raid would be on. Day and night, until we defeated the day raiders.
My guest is pianist George Shearing. Well, after the war, you decided, I guess, not to stay in London, and you wanted to at least make a few trips to the United States. What was the lure of America for you?
I met a few American musicians just before and a few more during the war. And all as if they were in one voice. Pretty well said, man, you should go over to the States. You kill them over there. Well, you know, I had acquired some ability to play in the styles of Teddy Wilson, Art Tatum, Fats Waller, and Bob Zirke, and people like that. But they had all this over here. You can't believe, when I first came over on the U.S., on the United States ship, I had letters to top flight agents. And I went around giving one audition after another. It became very evident to me very quickly that what I needed was an identity. And the identity was, of course, the George Shearing Quintet.
We'll hear more of our archive interview with George Shearing after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1986 interview with pianist George Shearing. It seems to me that in the last few years, you've been adding more and more popular song to your repertoire, playing with singers like Mel Torme, singing yourself. You've recently, I think it's recently, began singing.
Yeah, within
singing
the last 10 or 15
well.
Years, you know, recently, yeah.
What attracts you to a song when
lyrics,
you're using it?
Lyrics, and how the lyrics fit with the music. You know, and being able to make literary sense out of the song. For instance, everybody, and I do mean everybody that I've heard, when they do Send in the Clowns, they sing, "Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career." Now, would you say it that way? Losing my timing this late in my career? You would say, losing my timing this late in my career, wouldn't you? But it's partly Sondheim's fault. I love him. I love him dearly. We had a long talk one night in the Carlisle about Bach. He's a great Bach enthusiast. But people have to use a little bit of imagination, a little bit of ingenuity. Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. This is why I love songs.
I see what you mean with
yeah.
that. Did Sondheim agree with you?
I think so. In fact, I know he did. Yes. Yes, he agreed with me completely.
You've written songs as well, and I think your best known piece is Lullaby of Birdland. Can you tell us the story behind writing that?
Birdland needed a theme song for a six-hour disc jockey show that they had in the early 50s.
And Birdland was a club in New York in the 50s?
Right. Yes.
Mostly bop musicians playing
it. Right, yeah. Well, it was named for Charlie Parker, see, whose nickname was Bird. So I wrote this thing. I heard it in my head. I wrote it in 10 minutes. I always say 10 minutes and 35 years in the business. Over a steak in my dining room when I lived in New Jersey. I went back to that same butcher 1,000 times trying to get that same steak again. So they liked it, and they played it every hour on the hour, which is, of course, why it became my best-known song, because it was my only well-known song. When I go on as a composer, I said, I'd like to play you a medley of my hit, you know. But the thing is that when something is hammered through people's heads, like, of course it's going to, if it's got any substance at all that people can hang on to, of course it's going to become a hit, you know. And that's what happened with Lullaby. And, of course, we got over 100 people recording it.
I don't know if you wrote it with a lyric in mind or not, but
no.
I have heard it sung.
Yes.
And the first line is, I'm not going to sing it, maybe you'll do it, but they sing the first line with Lullaby of Birdland in it.
Yes, they do.
Do you want to just sing the line just to?
Yeah. Well, if you read it and you read it as if you're dividing the lines, you say, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Well, doesn't mean anything, does it, really? So, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Now, it means something because it's being read.
Did you, when you composed the song, hear the first phrase as being Lullaby of Birdland?
No. No. I just thought of this as a tune. And, in fact, I'm not even sure that... I mean, it was a theme song for Birdland. I don't even remember who gave it the title of Lullaby of Birdland.
When you first started living in the States in the 40s and the 50s, the jazz scene was having, jazz musicians were really having a lot of drug problems. There was a lot of heroin that was being used among jazz musicians then, and a lot of young musicians, partially, I think, to emulate some of their heroes like Charlie Parker, ended up shooting up and getting hooked on drugs. Did you ever run into any problems with that or come close to it? Was it hard for you to keep out of that?
Oh, no. I didn't take a glass of wine until I was 46 years old, never mind drugs or anything like that. I had people with me that took it. And provided they did their job, showed up on time and played as well as they would not, and that's a lot to ask, but if they could do it, it wasn't my business. I had a guy one night, and I'll protect him. I won't tell you his name. He called me about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, George, can I come up and see you for a minute? And I thought the manager had forgot to pay him or something, you know. So he came up. He sat on my bed. And he said, George. I said, yeah. Bob, what's the matter? I'm on drugs. And he cried. And I said, so you're on drugs? Now, what? What does that mean? And he told me that he didn't want to stay around long enough for the shame to mar my band and my reputation. And I said, when you are straight, your job will be there. time went on and we never did get together again. And I understand he is very straight now. But I also understand that he's not playing anymore and that he's teaching, doing something. So I hope he is. But you see, he was guilty enough. He felt guilty enough. What am I going to do? I'm not his keeper. I can't use them when they're like that and when they're not doing the job.
Had you realized that he was on drugs? And did you consider saying, oh, that's okay, you can stay, you're still performing?
I just thought his playing was kind of weak.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really do the job I imagined he could do. But I still waited, you know, in case he was going through a period of natural, you know, just not feeling up to par or something. And I'm patient, you know. And everybody protected him, of course. Wonderful group, you know.
You mentioned that you didn't drink, you didn't even have a glass of wine until you were 46.
Right.
Why not? Why not have some wine or an occasional
drink? My mother drank more beer than she needed to drink. And in the neighborhood that I lived in, I saw a lot of, although my family were not involved, I saw a lot of street fighting and a lot of stuff going on. And I didn't need it. I was afraid. I didn't want to be involved in anything less than a life where I could really know where I was, you know, coming from. And, you know, to this very day, I'm very conscious about knowing, you know, what's going on at all times.
What made you think then at age 46 that it was okay at that point to have a drink? Did you feel secure enough within yourself
so that you
knew you could drink in moderation?
I think that was probably it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your life and your playing today. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, and thank you. I hope we see you again.
Pianist George Shearing, recorded in 1986. Next Tuesday, he'll perform an 80th birthday concert at Carnegie Hall. Here's his 1975 recording of Happy Days Are Here Again. Thank you.
George Shearing. Coming up, new reissues by Ellington Sidemen. This is Fresh Air. A lot of Ellington reissues came out this year, in conjunction with the centenary of his birth last April. As the Ellington centenary year draws to a close, several notable recordings by Ellington's sidemen have been reissued, time for the Christmas season. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews four new reissues.
Trumpeter Cootie Williams, 1957, from the album Cootie Williams and Hi-Fi. It's one of four nifty new CDs from RCA, featuring star Ellington soloists in settings outside Duke's orchestra, even if they still play a few of his tunes. On Cootie Williams and Hi-Fi, with a tasteful studio orchestra to keep him company, the trumpeter shows off his beautiful tone on open horn, as well as his peerless command of the wah-wah plunger mute. The back half of the CD is given over to very different music recorded in 1957 by Williams's R&B-oriented big band, sometimes featuring singer Larry Dale or this one, Winnie Brown. Given the sophistication of Ellington's own writing, it's curious how often his musicians preferred to play down-home blues when out on their own. Another example is Duke's great balladeer, alto saxophonist Johnny Hodges. He's heard on the CD Wild Bill Davis and Johnny Hodges in Atlantic City, a live date from 1966. Hodges and Ellington trombonist Lawrence Brown sit in with Davis's earthy organ combo for some rollicking good time numbers, including two not on the original LP, and this one, Hodges' own Bell of the Belmont. Johnny Hodges shows off his sultry ballad style on another of these new reissues, Ellingtonia Moods and Blues. It was recorded in 1960 under the leadership of tenor saxophonist Paul Gonzalez and also features Ellington trumpeter Ray Nance. Gonzalez' claim to fame with Duke was up-tempo romps, but he had a beautifully luminous ballad tone himself. Here he is on Ellington and Billy Strayhorn's Daydream. Thank you. Finally, Paul Gonzalez and trumpeter Clark Terry front the so-called C-Jam All-Stars, a combo of Ellingtonians recorded during a European tour in 1958, with the obscure but okay German pianist Carlos Dierenhammer doing his best to fill Duke's shoes. That disc is called Diminuendo, Crescendo, and Blues, and naturally enough, it includes both Duke's C-Jam Blues and Gonzalez's perennial showcase with Ellington, Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue. These last two CDs include no additional material and clock in at a skimpy 36 minutes each, but all these reissues are budget-priced, so there's no cause for complaint. The two discs with Paul Gonzalez have never been available in the U.S. before, and the other two are new to CD. That would make these reissues good presents for Ellington fans who already have a shelf of the master's works, and also for those who don't.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed four RCA reissues, Cootie Williams in Hi-Fi, Wild Bill Davis and Johnny Hodges in Atlantic City, Paul Gonzalez, Ellingtonia Moods and Blues, and C-Jam All-Stars, Diminuendo, Crescendo, and Blues. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publishers of In the Spirit of Happiness by the Monks of New Skeet, available in hardcover wherever books are sold. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of I'll Be Home for Christmas, a compilation from the Library of Congress's archives commemorating those who kept the spirit of Christmas alive during World War II. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Bette Midler, and we'll remember two people who died in the past few days, actor and author Quentin Crisp and Tex-Mex rocker Doug Somm. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.